Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on moving forward where to. We have three speakers. They'll speak about 15 minutes each or thereabouts, and we'll take questions and discussion. Finish no later than 7 o'clock, perhaps a bit earlier. Glenn Milne makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here a couple of years ago. And Glenn Milne currently is a commentator for the Drum on the ABC and reports from Australia for Al Jazeera. Also appears on the Insiders program. He's going to lead off. Margot Savile's here. She's an ex-lawyer, a freelance journalist, writes for a number of publications and contributes also, well, including Crikey, and she's the author of The Battle for Bennelong, that is the previous Battle for Bennelong, and she wrote that book on Maxine McHugh's victory over John Howard 3 years ago. And Simon Benson will be the third speaker. Simon Benson is the chief national political reporter for the Daily Telegraph. He's formerly the Daily Telegraph's New South Wales political reporter. In 2001, he won the Australian Eureka Prize for environmental reporting. And Simon Benson's here around the release of his book, Betrayal, The Underbelly of Australian Labor, which came out shortly before the election and is still very topical. So we'll lead off with Glenn Milne, then we'll go to Margot Savile, then we'll go to Simon Benson, then we'll go to questions and discussion. Glenn, many thanks.
Well, thank you, Jared. Nice to be here. Well, welcome to the future. Today we throw out, I think, all or most of the old templates, and we deal with a new radical shift, I think, in the complexion of Australian politics. What Tony Blair has christened globally as an era of low predictability. Bismarck once famously remarked that politics is like sausages, you should never see how it's made. Well, I put it to you today that we are all in the sausage factory, and however the sausages turn out, we all as voters were responsible for making what's now going into the mix. And we got the sausages we intended. Not enough of us thought that Julia Gillard deserved to be returned. Not enough of us thought Tony Abbott deserved to be Prime Minister. We wanted some new ideas and some new directions, and now we've got them. By definition of a democracy, you can never get it wrong. For the moment, though, what strikes me most about the current political process is its utter transparency. To a degree never before witnessed, we are privy to a blow-by-blow account of how our democracy is putting itself together. For the next 3 years, for the next 3 months, for the next 3 weeks. I'll give you an example of what I mean by transparency. Before this election campaign, who knew about the faceless men? This was a term largely reserved to the political class. It is, of course, a reference to a description coined by Sir Robert Menzies, referring to the ALP National Executive, who, while completely unelected and unknown to the electorate, dictated policy to then Labor leader Arthur Caldwell and his ambitious deputy, one Edward Gough Whitlam. The blog sphere has certainly caught up with the term since Messrs. Arbib, Short and Feeney and others decided that Kevin Rudd's time was up and dispatched him at the witching hour. A former Labor staffer, who I won't mention but's here tonight, sent me a link the other day to a website called Faceless Men. It defines them as, quote, a religious society of assassins who worship the god of death. This guild, apparently, performs religious duties such as tending the dead. That's Kevin Rudd, you can hear stirring. For a price, the site says, and for that I read Election Victory, the Guild will kill anyone in the world considering this contract killing to be a sacrament to their God. An elite group of followers within the Guild, called the Faceless Men, are trained to perform this task. Despite their name, Faceless Men are occasionally women. Julia Gillard. So at that point I shut down the site. But there you have it. I couldn't have given you a more accurate account of the drama surrounding the assassination of Kevin Rudd. Let's take the opportunity here to talk about Kevin, because he remains relevant, not only because his ghost haunted and framed the election campaign, undermining Julia Gillard's claims to legitimacy, but also because he's now a major player in the minority Gillard government. The Rudd-Gillard dynamic will be pivotal to the future of the government. Indeed, it may determine whether it has a future at all. It will also be elemental to the nature of the relationship with Washington and on the issue of a regional solution to the perceived problem of asylum seekers. George Brandis, the Shadow Attorney General, is fond of telling me the key to character lies in repeated patterns of behaviour. So I contend that's the way it will be with Kevin. With that in mind, in January, I was a delegate to the Australian-American Leadership Dialogue. The dialogue, for those of you who aren't familiar with the program, is the premier public-private policy exchange between the US and Australia. Its clout and reach are tangible. This year we received private briefings from Hillary Clinton, World Bank President Bob Zelick, and former Bush Administration Security Chief John Negroponte. Kevin Rudd was also a delegate, though no one thought he would come so soon after his emotion-charged disposal as leader. Wrong. Kevin was there with bells on. What's not widely known is the depth of Labor's resentment at the meeting and the depth of antagonism that Rudd generated by his behaviour. It doesn't seem possible, but it's true. His actions at the dialogue actually deepened the contempt and anger Labor ministers and MPs felt for him at the time they dispatched him as leader. Present in Washington were Cabinet Ministers Stephen Conroy, Chris Bowen, Mark Bishop, one of the key anti-Rudd plotters, along with probable future Labor leader and now sworn minister, Jason Clare, Paul Howes, the 28-year-old AWU National Secretary, Enfant Terrible, who was the first to unsheathe the leadership knife against Rudd on national television. They were all there. It was a body language expert's dream. Other influential Labor characters included Stephen Loosley, David Epstein and Jeff Walsh. And just to add to the frisson that only the ALP can generate, Kim Beazley, the Labor leader Rudd dispatched, was there in his ambassadorial capacity. It started badly and it finished worse. Delegates arrived to a story running in the Sydney Morning Herald, written by the paper's political editor Peter Harcher, revealing that Barack Obama had made a bereavement phone call to Rudd after he lost the prime ministership. Peter, who spoke to this forum just recently, was in the US Capitol to address the dialogue on Australian domestic politics. He's regarded as close to Rudd. Perceptions are reality in politics. For the Labor cohort arriving at the meeting, there was no doubt Rudd's calling card was delivered via Harcher. The message was clear: I'm still relevant and I'm here. Rudd may as well have hired a skywriter. As the week drew to a close, he made several key interventions in the dialogue, including a speech to delegates at a social function at the Library of Congress, where he also happened to reveal that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had called him to commiserate over his lost leadership. During the conversation, they joked in biblical terms about political resurrections. You get the message. And if his intent by that time wasn't absolutely clear, he also had a drop-by meeting with US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and then he rushed ahead of the dialogue as it headed for New York to meet UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who announced Rudd's arrival by Twitter. The disbelief in his behaviour among Labor representatives, both in Washington and back home, was palpable. Unconfirmed reports swirled through the corridors outside the formal dialogue sessions that when Rudd and wife Therese vacated the lodge, he had told staff, "We'll be back." The anger was unsuppressed. As Rudd upped the ante, Beasley was heard to remark in the surrounds of the dialogue that Rudd still believed he was alive politically. Well, he is. But so is the revilement in the Labor Party towards him. If Rudd behaves like this as Foreign Minister, you had better fasten your seatbelts. Already he's representing Gillard in a major speech to the United Nations. The press release making the announcement was revealing. It began. Quote, "The Prime Minister and the incoming Foreign Minister have agreed that Mr. Rudd will visit Washington and New York from 17 September to 25 September, end quote. Well, as if Rudd would rush off and impersonate the Prime Minister at the UN. Then again, it's extraordinary that Gillard has to state that Kevin's movements as Foreign Minister are the subject of agreement. What this phraseology suggests is that the relationship between Rudd and Gillard has all the characteristics of an unexploded bomb. Asked this week for his assessment of the Gillard campaign, Rudd said he would not be commenting on its conduct. He could, of course. I mean, he could have said how well she performed. But he didn't. Watch this space. On the opposition side, the key relationship will be between Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull. It's an irony, but as a losing opposition leader, Tony is actually in a much stronger position within his own party than Gillard is as a winning Prime Minister. The shock absorber of his highly effective campaign, though not as effective as it needed to be, will protect Abbott in the medium term from any threat. But there are unresolved issues with Malcolm, as there always are, the most pertinent and potentially dangerous of which is that he remains in favour of a carbon price. It's hard to see him giving this position away, given it cost him his leadership to Abbott by a mere one vote. When crunch time comes on this, and Marius Klopper's intervention today has accelerated things, Malcolm may have no alternative but to resign from the shadow cabinet. Either that, or ditch his pro-carbon price stance and end up looking like Kevin Rudd. The executive aside, the Parliament itself will be endlessly fascinating. The confusion over the constitutionality of Rob Oakeshott becoming Speaker is only a taste of things to come. When they figure out how minority government is going to work effectively with a crossbench, I'll know too. And I'll come back to you. There will be real reforms to the way question time, parliamentary business and the like are conducted. This will be all for the good. The energy with which it is prosecuted, though, will depend on whether Oakeshott becomes Speaker. Most focus has been on the changes to question time, the requirement for ministers' answers to be short, 4 minutes, and believe it or not, for them to be relevant. But equally important has been the detail of the agreement Gillard has struck with Tony Windsor and Oakeshott. Private members' bills are required to be accommodated in the main chamber and with designated time allotted. They must be voted on. Now, those of you with a memory will recall that when Kevin Andrews introduced his anti-euthanasia bill to subvert the Northern Territory's legislation, the Parliament was frozen for months. Neither side of politics could get their message out, and the machinery of government ground to a halt as this contentious and emotional issue was debated. I'd suggest to you that there may well be repeats of that process. One piece of mere speculation here, but I think interesting nevertheless, is the question of whether this will lead to the Americanisation of Australian politics. Not only are Windsor and Bob Katter and rob Oakeshott powerful in a hung parliament. As Oakeshott continues to point out, so are the other 150 MPs. Potentially compliant and powerful individual MPs. Big money and influence politics may loom. I will hazard some other predictions. Tasmanian independent Andrew Wilkie will be the weak link in the chain that is minority government. Despite acting against type by adopting to support the government, Tony Windsor and Oakeshott have some threads of ideological DNA. They're both socially conservative, for example. Their behaviour will be somewhat predictable. Wilkie has no ideological consistency. He comes from the generally conservative intelligence community. He then became a left-wing celebrity amongst the Howard haters, both for his opposition to the Iraq War and his personal campaign against the then Prime Minister in Bennelong. He then ran for the Greens in the Senate and finally washed up in Hobart as a carpet salesman and an independent. In other words, Wilkie is thoroughly unpredictable. More than that, I think he enjoys the limelight. So, a dash of ego and a sprinkling of national notoriety, and you have the recipe for someone who wants to stand out in the parliament. And the only way to do that is to consistently keep the Gillard government on the knife edge of a lost vote. Finally, by comparison with Wilkie, the Greens are very much in the tent. In fact, Julia Gillard may not be aware of how far. There was much rejoicing at the reasonableness of the deal Gillard signed with the Greens to enlist their cooperation in the Senate and secure Adam Bandt's vote in the lower house. It was Harold Macmillan who, questioned by a young reporter as to the most difficult thing of his prime ministership, replied, "Events, dear boy, events." So I think it will be with the Greens. The deal is not as important as how much Bob Brown's overall philosophy will inform his weekly meetings with the Prime Minister, and therefore the political and policy imperatives and atmospherics of the new government. The left vote in Australia has splintered, perhaps irrevocably, between the Greens and the ALP. It is the Greens who are on the march. Gillard will be doing everything in her power to recover Labor's diabolical primary vote. This may well mean embracing more Green positions. You have to wonder how, though, when Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young today likened the Darwin Refugee Detention Centre to Guantanamo Bay. Clearly, the Greens believe that they can continue to move leftwards and take more of Labor's high-educated and high-income vote. Gillard will have to pay the piper. Sometimes it's informative in politics to go back to original sources. When you go to the Greens policy website, a sustainable economy, as a heading, ranks number 7 in their list of priorities, right after media, arts and science. Under the economy, equity is the emphasis, followed by themes of collectivism, industry policy, government ownership of natural monopolies, regulation of the market, and opposition to the goods and services tax, would you believe? I did say at the outset, welcome to the future. Well, that is the future as Bob Brown sees it. I hope tonight I've set a few straws in the wind, and I'd welcome your questions. Thank you very much for having me.
Gosh, this is exactly like being back at the Rooty Hill RSL, except you're all much, much better dressed. I'm not going to speak for very long tonight because I have a slight throat infection, so I do apologise if my voice sounds a bit strange. When Jared and Anne kindly asked me to be on this panel tonight, my first thought was, is it safe for a journalist from Crikey to appear on the same platform as Glenn Milne? But we seem to be getting on famously, and so I think I'm okay. In order to prepare for tonight's talk, I tried to analyse the topic, and it seemed to be a very wide topic, and I was trying to think, did Gerard and Anne mean, where do I think we are moving forward, or to where do I think we are moving forward, or to where would I like us all to be moving forward? If it's the first meaning, where do I think we're moving forward, the short answer would have to be, probably not a clue. With the qualifier, anyone who would publicly venture an opinion on this topic is probably brave or foolhardy. And by the way, the next person who uses the word paradigm in my presence, I would like to actually take away and shoot. And that was until I opened the Herald on Wednesday and saw that our esteemed host had written a column entitled How to Make a New Paradigm, in which he did express several extremely well-founded and erudite opinions on the new model of politics, as did Glenn. So I think probably we should just wait until the end and ask Gerard some questions. So I think the only thing I'm really qualified to talk about is where would I like us all to be moving forward? And so on this area, I prepared a long list of things that I would like to gain some importance in the new government. But it's very hard to write a list that doesn't end up sounding like a cross between Khalil Gibran and a Hallmark greeting card. You start at the top with world peace and no child should live in poverty, and you end up with no verbal abuse in question time, and there's an awful lot of aspirational statements in between. So I think basically what I would like from the new government is that it works more effectively than the last one, and actually passes some legislation which reflects some of the policies which actually got it elected. And although, of course, it's much too early to tell, there were three stories in the newspapers this week which gave me some hope that this aim may actually come true. The first story was Tuesday's news poll in The Australian, which indicated that the primary support for both the Coalition and Labor had dropped since the election, while backing for the Greens and the independent MPs had surged. And the conclusion from the news poll, and I apologise if anybody here has read it and analysed it, I'll be repeating what you already know, but a clear majority of the voters in the news poll research had also validated the decision of the independent MPs to back Labor to form a minority government over the Coalition, even though they weren't hopeful that it would go a full term, but they were quite happy with the result. And as you all know, there'd been many predictions during that 17-day hiatus, which seemed to stretch to 18 days as we were listening to Rob Oakeshott. Who was it who said, have gone to read War and Peace, has Rob Oakeshott made a decision yet? And there had been many, many predictions before the independents made up their minds that if we had another election, the voters would flock back to the major parties because they preferred certainty in the status quo, which I think points to the difficulty of making predictions about the electorate at large. And I think that... Now, I always describe the news poll as being terribly authoritative and definitive when I like the result, and a load of old crap when I don't. And I think that this time it was an encouraging result in that I felt that the people polled had liked the result and therefore were less likely to try and change things, and that we therefore had in some form or some shape a stable government, however strange it may look. The other two pieces of news, good news, that I read this week in the newspaper was a story about Clive Palmer urging Tony Abbott to get involved in the parliamentary negotiation for a profit-based mining tax. And as we all know, Clive Palmer is a huge donor to the Coalition and was one of the most vocal opponents of the mining super profits tax while it was being proposed. But he was quoted as saying in the newspaper this week, so this wasn't hearsay or Chinese whispers or someone trying to get out a story using Clive Palmer. He was actually quoted as saying the Coalition should get involved to influence the outcome, because there really hasn't been enough debate. And during the election campaign, you were either for the tax or against it as it was proposed. The Coalition said it was not in favour of new big taxes, but that shouldn't mean that they are not in favour of tax reform to move to something that is profit-based. there should be a broad debate about a profit-based tax and about how the tax system can be used to encourage downstream processing of minerals in Australia. And I was greatly encouraged by that, because I think that's what you want from your business leaders. Although they often talk a lot of nonsense during an election campaign because they have their own agenda, but at the end of the day, they just want to make money for their shareholders. And I think that if Clive Palmer is using this sort of conciliatory language and calling for a negotiation about a profits-based tax, then I think that that's a very good sign. And I take back all the really bad things I've ever said about him in the past. Including his hair colour. Can anyone explain it? No. Okay. The third piece of good news was, of course, Glenn's already referred to this, which was the head of BHP, Billiton Murray Cloppers, who came out yesterday saying he wanted the government to do something about climate change now rather than waiting for the rest of the world. In a public address, he called for a combination of a carbon tax, regulations, land use actions, and perhaps a limited trading system. Now, all of these statements are a very long way from the sort of stupid brain-snapping slogans that we heard during the election, like moving forward and stop the boats and great new tax. And incidentally, has anyone heard a word about stopping the boats since election night? Has anybody heard anybody in public say stop the boats? No. So presumably they've stopped. I don't know. And so these three pieces of news tell me three things: that the population at large has accepted the new arrangement, that the business community has accepted it and is now prepared to work with the new government, however long that may last. And that if Marius Cloppers has come out saying that we need to do something about climate change, then, you know, he really should be CEO of the year, because that's a very brave statement. And I take back all the bad things I've ever said about South Africans. But I'm hoping that this new political landscape means that more people will think about a role in politics. Is there anyone in this room who has ever put their hand up for a role in public life? For political? No. See, I'm looking at a sea of very well-educated people. You all look fairly well-resourced. And my guess is there's a fair few retirees here who could give a lot back to the community. And none of you, including me, has ever put your hand up for public office. And I don't include being a trustee of Shaw. You know, I mean local, state, federal politics, you know. And I think that if some flake like Andrew Wilkie can get up and win a seat, you know, I really don't see why a bunch of extremely well-educated people who presumably know a lot about life can't do the same. And I just wanted to talk very briefly about Tony Windsor and the way he relates to his electorate. And I was having a discussion about this the other night, about Tony and his relationship with his electorate. And I was asking a friend of mine who actually lives in the electorate of Wentworth, and I said, do you think there's an analogy here? Do you think that Malcolm has the kind of relationship with his electorate that Tony obviously does with the people of Tamworth and Armidale? And he said, well, I think with Malcolm it's more one way. You know, I think, yes, I receive a lot of information from Malcolm, I receive a lot of invitations, but it's kind of more one way. It's kind of Malcolm telling me what he's doing. And I said, well, Tony, I think, is doing a little bit more on that area. And I have some inside knowledge here, because Tony's number one voter is my mother, who lives in Armidale and has had Tony as a local member for the entire time he's been there. And my mother for years has been banging on to me about Tony and what a brilliant politician he is, and how he sends, not just her, every member of the electorate, he sends out very detailed questionnaires on all sorts of topics, like tax policy, budget considerations, foreign policy. For instance, when the mining tax was being proposed, he sent out a questionnaire to every single person in his electorate. And my mother doesn't have a computer, so it comes through her mailbox. And if you answer these questionnaires, as she does, you then get invited onto panels, and then on the panels you're asked to give your opinion, and my mother's very opinionated, and so she feels this very close connection to Tony Windsor. And in fact, I think since election night, she's probably convinced she's running the country. And I think that's a very interesting model for a politician, because I live in a street which is the exact boundary between the electorates of Sydney and Graindler. So we receive electioneering material for both Tandy Plibersek and Anthony Albanese. And incidentally, apart from being a journalist, as a constituent, I have never laid eyes on either of them. They have never door knocked me. They have never come to a community event. And I have two children, so I go to lots of community events. You know, I have never seen hide nor hair of them. All I receive at election time is materials telling me what they've done. Which is bugger all, as far as I'm concerned. And so, you know, I think if we're going to be talking about the future of politics, I think we need to be looking at people like Tony Windsor and Rob Oakeshott, although he's rather more controversial at the moment, and thinking about that, and thinking about maybe ways that instead of doing what I do, which is to sit back and judge politicians rather harshly, but to actually think about politics personally, as a personal choice, and seeing what we can do, because I think we're entering a very exciting new era. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard and Anne, for inviting me along tonight to speak, and particularly for plugging my book. I hope there's enough to go around at the end. The curse of the third speaker, I apologise in advance if I'm slightly repetitive, but I hope that I can provide some different insights into what I think has been going on and what I think may go on in the future. Unfortunately, this topic presents infinitely more questions than it does answers. But before we get too concerned about the vagaries of our own current national political situation, I think there's an international comparison that's quite good. I read some unflattering commentary in the Chinese press yesterday about one of its neighbours, which also happens to be the world's second biggest economy and suffers from its own instability, political instability. It reads, three elections for Prime Minister in a year reflect the embarrassment and volatility of Japan's political system. Since 2000, except for Prime Minister Koizumi's five-year continuous governance, the average of all other Prime Ministers' terms is less than a year. The frequent change of Japanese Prime Minister is attributed, among other things, to its economic performance, but also the political system, party mechanisms, which I've construed as being factional rivalry, and public opinion. Now, I think only New South Wales probably has a record to rival that of Japan. And it's New South Wales where I think we can find some of the origins of how we got to this point in Australian politics. The reality is that the issues now facing the federal government, and by that I mean the Labor Party, go to the core of its own modern structures. It is adrift, it doesn't know what it stands for, and although it recognises the problem, it's still mired in this focus group, political, spin-driven approach to government that has proved disastrous not only in New South Wales, but also federally. And there are a number of lessons out of this election for Labor. An obvious one was clearly that they underestimated, or they wrongly assumed, that Tony Abbott was unelectable. Another is that Labor can no longer ignore the dysfunction within its own machinery, within the party. It's a machine that not only destroyed a government in New South Wales, but sacked a Prime Minister and crippled a federal government as well. And there can be no doubt that the wrecking ball that swung through New South Wales paid an unwelcome visit to Canberra, and we all saw what happened there. Paul Keating predicted a lot of this when I interviewed him about a year ago for the book that's here tonight on the bleak future of Labor if it continued down the path that it was on. And it was certainly something alluded to in the Hawke Rann review following the 2001 election loss, which was an abysmal loss for Labor. I called the book Betrayal. Superficially, the title refers to a promise made and then later broken by Kevin Rudd to help Morris Yemma in 2007 when he and his treasurer, Michael Costa, were pursuing plans to privatise state-owned electricity assets against considerable opposition from their own party in the trade union movement. But at a deeper level, it was intended, the title was really intended, to be a betrayal by the New South Wales Labor machine of the values and ideals that people like Keating tried to instill to ensure that Labor became a party that was capable of reform but also able to govern from the middle ground. In it, and I'd like to quote Keating here because I think this is particularly relevant, when he refers to the machine, he says, "I think the problem with centre unity, in that sense the New South Wales right, is that it lacks now an ideology. When I say ideology, it lacks ideology other than the sheer pursuit of power. Clear enough about that. But power for what and to do what? When the motivation of the machinery is unfurnished as to policy purpose, it has nothing more to offer than to focus on marketing and polls." Keating was talking specifically about New South Wales, but more broadly about the party at a national level. And I think this has become transparently evident during the election campaign. In a column I wrote yesterday for the Daily Telegraph, where I work, I suggested there were other stories to have emerged from the election beyond the obvious one of a hung parliament, which, while specific to the Labor Party, also have implications for how this government will actually govern. Julia Gillard nominated the problem in her address to caucus last week, where she said, "We have to articulate what the Labor Party stands for, or what the Labor purpose is." Now, I think it's rather odd that a government can come to power on such a premise. And her ability to address this issue has become considerably more difficult on forming a government that, in an ideologically sense, is conflicted, this rainbow coalition that's been described as. But just diverging from this a bit, one of the developments which I think has emerged, and one that this government is very mindful of, but it won't talk about, is how it dramatically shed some of its sizeable ethnic bases, its communities, at the election. And while it's not central to the issues that it faces as a government and parliament, it provides at least one element of a broader context as to how we got here to this point, and one that's paid very little attention. And I raise this because no government seeks to govern without an eye on its own electability. And that eye will be firmly focused on Queensland and New South Wales. A Labor staffer whose work booths in the southern Sydney, southwestern Sydney electorates for 20 years told me that in Watson he had mainland and Hong Kong Chinese, Pakistanis, Sri Lankans, Indians and Lebanese walk straight past him at the booths, snubbing their noses at the how to vote. Labor how to vote cards, and he said it's the first time he's seen such a thing in his 20 years of working the booths. This was Labor's heartland. The post-war Greek and Italian communities kept it that way. Seats such as Banks, Watson, Werriwa, Reid and Fowler were all considered unassailable Labor seats. So forget the spin that suggests that New South Wales did okay because Labor didn't shed as many seats as it did in Queensland. The reality was a disaster for them, and it will have a significant impact on how Julia Gillard intends to try and govern. The swings in those seats were savage. They averaged between 8 and 13%, three of them held by ministers. The only buffer for those seats was the enormous margins they were already on. They were among the safest Labor seats in the country, not anymore. To appreciate the significance of this seismic shift, I think we can go back to 1988 and John Howard's One Australia policy. As part of his social agenda then, a lot of you would remember that he suggested that the Asian migration rate be slow. And as the Australian's Paul Kelly has recorded, a generation of Asian voters flocked to Labor. These voters stuck with Labor. Even when Keating lost in 1996, those seats stuck with only minor swings against them compared to the avalanche everywhere else. In this election, in New South Wales, the reverse was the case. Not discounting the other significant issues facing Labor at the election, and they are obvious, I think a large part of this swing, and I'm told by people who have manned those booths down there and know them very well, that the swing in those seats can be attributed, among other things, to the moment Julia Gillard started talking about shrinking Australia. Labor had a gut feeling that this desperate attempt to appeal to extremes in just a single seat of Lindsay might offend a lot of its own people elsewhere. Ironically, 22 years later, a generation on, and Labor's faux pas on immigration and population appears to have repeated the Howard mistake of a generation ago. But this time it offended new migrants from Asia, the subcontinent and the Middle East. Those in government now who recognise what happened here, and there's only a few of them, are concerned about it, and they are now asking the question, is this our John Howard's 1988? But there's a conundrum here. Why would they go to the coalition then? Some federal deniers, and there's plenty of them in Canberra, suggested the exodus of voters in those southwest Sydney seats must have had more to do with the state government, which is a compelling argument. But the inconvenient truth for Labor is that it was a protest vote from their traditional ethnic base in middle suburbia. They didn't like the immigration whistle, they didn't like Gillard's atheism, and a lot of them didn't like the idea of sacking Rudd, even if they didn't like him. Which brings me to the second part of this story for Labor, and that's the protest vote from the other base, Labor's left. How a party so comprehensively offended voters from both ends of its own political spectrum may never be known. Whether it was immigration, refugees, climate change or a whole range of other things, there was a distinct shift away from Labor in the inner city seats. I think Margot referred to Graindler before. It was, I think, Labor's safest seat in the country. It's now on a margin of 3%. It was almost lost to the Greens, as did happen in Melbourne. So clearly a lot of people looking for social justice didn't find comfort in Labor. It was once the party that laid claim to innovation, humanitarianism, compassion and social justice. And if you remember in 1990, it was also the party of the environment. But instead of fighting on these issues, Gillard has ceded this ground to the Greens. And in the process, she's legitimised them as a mainstream alternative for middle-class left-wing voters who would otherwise have voted Labor. There's been a lot of criticism of the New South Wales right and the lack of policy and principle that it presents. But by signing an alliance with the Greens, a formal alliance with the Greens to form government, Gillard has also effectively sanctioned the demise of her own faction, the Labor Left, by telling 500,000 disaffected Labor voters that it's okay to vote Greens. Gillard had no reason to sign a deal with the Greens. She had their support anyway. The long-term impact of this alliance is already apparent. This week's news poll, and again Margot referred to this, it pushed Labor's primary vote to a new historic low of 34%. The Hawke-Keating model of sensible broad-based Labor Party government has been flushed down the drain. Labor will not be able to govern again on a primary vote of this size without a formalised arrangement with the Greens in the future. And my apologies to Margot again, but if we're going to talk about a new paradigm, I think that this is it. Although we only have one other instance by which to compare it with, the makeup of this hung parliament is quite extraordinary. We've got a Labor Party that is flanked at one end by two conservative country independents, at the other end by a rather less conservative Greens MP, and a man who I think most political analysts would find hard to pigeonhole, which may or may not be the product of his former life as a spy, Andrew Wilkie. But all of them have strongly indicated that they will only support the government on supply and confidence and not necessarily policy. So what does this all mean for the stability of government and for the future? The most likely outcome, I think, is a medium to long-term Labor government, timid in its policy prescription, unlikely to engage difficult reform and obsessed with hanging on to power. Of course, there's a possibility that the entire show will come crashing down within months. But as Machiavelli suggested, self-interest is a powerful motivator. I suspect that the independents who now have a sense of relevance will seek to keep this parliament afloat for as long as possible. But it's also possible that Tony Abbott will be able to get significant legislation through the parliament himself, leading to an unprecedented situation where you have an opposition being effectively in a position to occasionally govern from the non-Treasury benches. And I think this is where the new parliament becomes interesting, but also potentially disastrous. If you lose absolute control of the parliament, then you can potentially also lose control of the budget. In the space of 2 weeks, we've already seen a significant rewriting of our national priorities for the purpose of forming government. And there are a number of key areas where there will be potential problems with this. Apart from the longevity of the government itself, the national broadband network was a key policy area that the two crucial independents in New South Wales cited as being critical to their decision. And I think Tony Abbott's made a very shrewd decision appointing Malcolm Turnbull as the communications shadow. Labor has yet to produce a business case for the national broadband network. It's already facing accusations that it doesn't stack up. And this project in itself already marks a significant shift away from the old ethos. Australia went through a period of deregulation starting with Hawke and Keating, and their motto in government was to steer, not row the boat. The private sector was brought in to do the hard yards. To quote the former New South Wales Treasurer Michael Costa recently, "You'd have to go back to Rex Connor to see projects of this scale being undertaken by the private sector, by the public sector, sorry. And now we have one without a business case. Its only known rival is the gravity-defying over-the-horizon radar. Despite all the criticisms of state governments, it is the federal governments that have a poor track record on service and project delivery. If nothing else, the BER and the home insulation disasters prove this point. They were more incompetent than anything a state government has done, including public transport ticketing systems." Now, I think Turnbull will bring significant pressure to bear on the government over this issue. It is one big policy area that brought it currency with the independents, and ironically I think it could also become its Achilles heel. It's in this same portfolio area that Stephen Conroy's proposed internet filter falls, and the Greens have already expressed their opposition to this, putting another policy area in doubt. The broader national issue, of course, is this redistribution of services and investment from metropolitan centres to the regional areas that have been already agreed to, such as the subsidising of broadband for regional customers, health funding and infrastructure funding, which total around $10 billion. Already, ministers that I've spoken to privately are expressing concern that their own portfolio areas will be shaved to contribute to the regional development package. That's not to mention the next round of health funding, which has been brought forward, and quarantines, $1.8 billion to go to regional hospital programs and infrastructure at the expense of metropolitan services, which no one could argue aren't in as much need. It is highly likely that this government will have other things foisted upon it, which it won't like. The government will have to keep buying off the Greens and independents through the course of this government, or this parliament. And that is before we even talk about tax reform, the mining tax, a potential price on carbon, all of which are now likely to be subject to considerable pressure and even amendment from the Greens in the Senate. This inherently unstable arrangement has the potential for pressure on the budget, and I think that's important to note. The normal checks and balances in the budget process and the scrutiny of expenditure will be subsumed by politics. The government may get away with it for a while because they're in a good position fiscally, but any notion of getting the budget back to surplus in the three-year timeframe period promised is surely in doubt now. Those in favour of this new inclusive style of government cite hung parliaments at a state level as examples of how they can work positively in a public policy sense. I'm not sure the New South Wales government would agree that the ICAC, which was born from the hung parliament under Nick Reiner, has been good for them, although it has provided an endless source of entertainment for the opposition. To cite the New South Wales example again, for 15 years, Labor has not enjoyed numbers in the upper house. This has forced the government to traditionally do deals with conservative elements such as the Christian Democrats and the Shooters to get legislation through. In return, they would often have to support their positions on other issues. Nothing extraordinary about that. On other occasions, it would be the Greens. But whenever their bills got to the upper house, they knew that there would be endless horse trading to get them through, and often they didn't. Critical areas of microeconomic reform were blocked, Maurice Yemmer and Michael Costa's electricity industry privatisation bills were the most dramatic examples of that, and it cost them their jobs. The truth is that the state Labor government spent more time withdrawing legislation from the Legislative Council than it did getting it passed. And unless Julia Gillard elects a senior person to handle the crossbenchers, she will find herself also wound up in endless negotiation. If she intends to do it herself, we're likely to see an even more inward-looking government, one which is constantly battling for its survival rather than tending to its other responsibilities, such as those in foreign policy, which Glenn alluded to. The Prime Minister appears content to sublet her responsibilities in the international arena to the man she deposed, Kevin Rudd. And this is already apparent in her willingness to allow Rudd to take her place at those UN meetings that you mentioned before, Glenn. There will likely be foreign leaders there who will be wondering whether Kevin Rudd is still the Prime Minister of Australia. Which brings me to another point, the US elections in 2012. Assuming this government survives until then, it may pose a new set of potential problems should Barack Obama fail to secure a second term. How will a Labor-Greens alliance, one of which one party is highly critical of our ties with the US, deal with a possible Republican administration? The only question that I think can be safely answered about any of this is that we have a government that will dance to the beat of a different drum. And we must remember that support for this government only goes as far as they believe the government is competent. The only thing that the government actually has going for it is that Julia Gillard is now the incumbent. If she can survive 2 years and put enough distance between her and the problems of the past, it's not inconceivable that she could restore Labor's fortunes and win an election in her own right. And this is where the independents, I think, have probably erred, believing that the greatest threat to an earlier than expected election actually lay with Tony Abbott. If Gillard gets in a position where she is running high and her popularity is up, the temptation for Labor to go in an election will be great. While many other things may have changed with this new parliament, one thing won't change, and that is politics. In conclusion, I think the only certainty is that this will be a survival government. It won't be a reformist government, if you exclude the parliamentary reform. More importantly, the potential for parliamentary gridlock, I think, is greater than it ever has been as a result. Thanks.
So thanks to our three speakers. Thanks also to Mellisons for the use of this facility this evening. And as I mentioned earlier, the copies, Janet Grundy down the back's got copies of Simon Benson's book, Betrayal, the Underbelly of Australian Labor. So now we come to question discussion. I think I'll just get the three of you up here and talking to the microphone would be the easiest way to do it. So questions and discussion. I'll start off with asking a question to Margot about your mother.
Could I be Tony Abbott and sit in the audience?
No. No, you can't. Can I ask you a question about your mother? You said that Tony Windsor asked all his constituents about what he ought to do, but... Oh, it doesn't matter. I'd love to hear the answer. We said that Tony Windsor asked all his constituents about what he ought to do, but he didn't ask anyone, including your mother, did he, about who he ought to support as a government, did he?
She hasn't mentioned that, so I'm sure she would have mentioned it, so I'd say no.
There you go. Right, so... everyone's remarkably quiet for the Sydney Institute. There we go.
Any of the comments, really. If the independents are asked which of the parties they would support in a hung parliament, what would be the outcome in the next election? How will that play?
Well, I think the question is what's likely to happen in the independent seats at the next election in view of the stance that they took after the last election.
If I could just clarify, if candidates are asked by their electorate Who would then support him in Hong Kong?
I've got an answer to that for one of them.
Well, okay. Well, quickly, Glenn.
Yes. Well, the news poll suggests that they made the wrong decision. That's the published polling that we've got, suggests that, you know, these are basically three quite conservative electorates. In the case of Kennedy and Bob Catt, are very conservative electorates. So the published evidence is that they went the wrong way, according to the judgment of their own constituents. What happens to them in the next election will depend, to a large extent, on how the National Party behaves. I'd suggest they will go after, to use a quote we're familiar with this week, ferociously. They'll go after them ferociously in their own seats as a result of the fact that they backed Labor. The only caveat to that, of course, is that if Rob Oakeshott becomes Speaker, there'll be, you know, a break on the National Party, because they won't want to go after an independent Speaker as ferociously as another vulnerable independent.
So, I agree with everything you say, Glenn, but the only caveat I put that on that would be the seat of Lyne and Northern New South Wales with Rob Oakeshott. I think that, and if what I'm hearing is correct amongst the ranks of the Liberal Party, they're suggesting that they are already talking about wanting to run a candidate in a three-cornered contest. There, I think that Rob Oakeshott would be in a lot of trouble, and the Libs could probably pick that seat up.
Margie, do you want to comment on that?
My own personal opinion is I think that once the people in those electorates get all those fantastic extra hospitals and schools and bus shelters and all those things that we're all going to be paying for soon, I think they'll possibly like their local members even more.
Okay, all three of you, just talk to the back of the room is the way to go. Anne?
I want to go back to what Glenn took us through and bring the other thing as well. It seems to me that we're looking at a 3 years, if we last that long, of absolutely nothing happening except process. And all of Australian history has shown that whenever Australians are faced with that unsettled, indecisive, don't know what's coming next government, the next election is sure as anything straight to a definite clear majority. How do you think this will work out? And Kevin Rudd thrown in as well. I mean, he thinks he's the Prime Minister.
Thanks, Anne. I think it's going to depend on who shows the direction first. And it gets to Simon's point about Labor being there for the pursuit of power and the pursuit of power only. And I think that's going to be exaggerated by the inward-looking nature of the government. So Tony Abbott at the moment, I think, is presenting a more direction-focused opposition than Gillard is presenting a direction-focused government. Now, how that will pan out, you know, over the medium to longer term, I'm not sure. But I'd suggest whoever gets this country by the scruff of the neck first will win the next election. And probably, I agree with you, Anne, people are after a direction. They want to be told where to, or shown where to go, and I think whoever recognises that first will win.
Somebody want to add to that?
Only briefly, I think irrespective of what happens at a policy level, I think the Labor Party, there will be a temptation, once they've finally worked out what's happened to them, there will be a temptation for them to want to win back the territory that they lost most significantly to the Greens, that their primary vote is so bad now that they, as I mentioned before, they can't possibly hope to govern without some sort of arrangement with the Greens on that sort of primary vote. So I think there'll be a temptation for them to fight their real enemies now, which isn't just the coalition, it's the Greens. I think that's the greatest risk. I think Chris Schott a couple of weeks ago summed it up, saying that this formal alliance, by actually signing a formal alliance with the Greens, may render them the same way as the Social Democrats in Europe, that they've only ever get a 30% primary vote and have to govern with a formal coalition or alliance with the centre-left parties.
Okay.
I just want to add one factoid to that observation, and that is that Wayne Swan was only elected in his seat on green preferences. We've now got a treasurer putting together a budget who's beholden to the Greens in his own seat.
So there's a question over there. Yes, just wait a second. Yes.
The media recently has had a lot of criticism of News Limited, particularly Laura T. Gordon, Barry Cassidy, and obviously Bob Brown as well, and the list goes on. Paul Barry on Media Watch the other night. So we've got a couple of News Limited acolytes, or one ex News Limited acolyte. These people seem to think that News Limited is the real opposition. So how do you see that playing out over the next few years with News Limited holding the government to very close scrutiny on almost any micro issue? So I'd be interested in Glenn's view on that first, and Simon's view second, and also the Beecher Group Crikey view on that as well.
Well, Glenn used to be the leader of the opposition, and Simon now is. So.
Every deputy. I think the criticism is directed at the Australian. I think there's two issues here. I think the Australian is a self-declared centre-right newspaper. It has an agenda. You know, it's free market, pro the US alliance. It has those benchmarks, and it's in favour of a more deregulated labour market. I think they're the three key things. And I think it prosecutes that case. I think it prosecutes it unashamedly, and I think it's good for the country. By comparison, I'd point to the Sydney Morning Herald, which I've been appalled at, in the sense that in the first week after the election was over, on some days they didn't carry the story about the hung parliament on the front page. You know, this is an historic event. This is uncharted territory. It's unprecedented, and yet it seems to have been relegated to the back pages. So that's by way of invidious comparison. The other issue, though, I think with the Australian, and I think this is one that is really attracting the heat, although it's not often specified, is the way Newspoll is treated. Now, I think that raises a whole different set of issues, namely whether we should, you know, how public opinion is driven by public polls rather and led by it. And I think that we have to address in this country the issue of whether we actually ban polls in the last week of a campaign so that people can make up their own minds and they're not driven by the interpretation of the published polls in papers like The Australian.
Being a member of the Working Press News Limited, I'll be careful about what I say. I think the one thing that it bugs me about this sort of debate is that that politicians, and perhaps even some of those journalists that you mentioned, never tell you the other side of the story, which is what politicians do and how they try and manipulate the press and the things that they get up to. And when it doesn't go their way, they get a little bit upset. The Telegraph vigorously prosecutes its case. It will continue to do so. I suspect our relationship with the federal government will continue as it always has. It's very constructive. I think some of the Fairfax press has been left wanting as well, actually, on this issue, and particularly the deliberate, attempts to ignore particular issues. And as you suggested, a couple of days after the election, the paper that espouses to be the Journal of Record didn't even have politics on the front page. So,
wasn't in Sydney.
Of course it wasn't. So, look, that's probably all I'd say about that.
Margot, do you want to put a crikey perspective on all this?
No.
Just talk to the end of it.
Oh, sorry. Just very briefly, I've worked for Rupert Murdoch, Kerry Packer, everybody, Fairfax, the ABC, everyone. And can I say, in terms of good working conditions and editorial freedom and, well, where I was definitely the best paid was definitely Kerry Packer. I don't want to speak on behalf of Crikey because I've only been there a short time. But I think that journalists talking about journalism is the same way I feel about people playing golf. I don't mind if people do it, as long as they don't do it in front of me. And I find it really kind of uninteresting in that
we don't live in Romania and everyone's got a choice, and if we don't like the Herald, then just don't buy it.
Oh, hang on. I think you should buy the Herald. Okay, now, there's a young woman here, Anne, if you just come up here, and then we'll go around the back. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There's been a lot of criticism of the Labour Party and as well of the independents and their decision to side with the Labour Party. But I'm wondering why there's not more criticism of the coalition, given that they didn't win the election in the face of what was probably the worst campaign that a lot of people had seen from the Labour Party, plus the Nye thing, which was really fresh in people's memory. And how can they not be criticised in that they couldn't convince two conservative independents from conservative electorates to join the conservative alliance? Isn't it because their policies were so uninspiring and their budgeting was so inadequate that they weren't able to do this? Why isn't there more criticism of the coalition?
Well, the question about the coalition.
It's a very, very good question, and I think naturally incumbents are probably going to get a bit more attention. Governments always get a bit more attention than oppositions. I agree. You'd probably have to look through the pages to find those sorts of criticism. But I think one of the criticisms I'd make of the coalition was that it lost the election in New South Wales partly because of the campaign it ran in New South Wales. I mean, you can talk about Labor's a bungled campaign, but the Liberal Party didn't even do any postal vote campaigning in Lindsay, Greenway, seats like that. I mean, there's a one-seat difference in Parliament that would otherwise have the coalition in government, two seats, sorry, and they didn't have candidates in Greenway or Lindsay until after the election was called. So I think the Liberal Party in New South Wales has a lot of soul searching to do on this issue. But that when you talk about why they didn't win because Labor ran an appalling campaign, they actually almost did win, and had it not been for if they got their act together a little bit earlier in New South Wales, they'd probably be in government. Just quickly on the alliance, I don't think it was any lack of ability to negotiate. Tony Abbott's a very good negotiator, and so is Bill Heffernan when he wants to be. They managed to get Jared was talking about this earlier privately with me, that Bill Heffernan managed to get Bob Catter over the line. So they got one of them. The other two have long-running issues with the National Party, which are very personal. Rob Oakeshott has deep resentment towards the National Party for some personal issues that I won't go into. The way they treated Tony Windsor in New South Wales was appalling. I think it was Anderson that got up and said after Tony Windsor was elected that everyone in New England was an idiot. So, I think those things really probably were at the heart of why those two guys went to Labor. And I don't think any amount of negotiating on behalf of Tony Abbott or anybody else in the coalition could have swayed them.
I think one thing that Tony Abbott's really culpable on is that Malcolm Turnbull wasn't in the front bench. I mean, here we are after the election with Tony Abbott saying, that Malcolm Turnbull will make the difference in this term. And why wasn't he there in the first place? I mean, he wanted to be on the front bench, and given that their broadband policy was such a catastrophe, the famous interview with Kerry O'Brien where Tony declared he wasn't a tech head, given all that context, I mean, if Malcolm had been there, it might have made the difference.
This morning, Alan Jones really went to town to super criticise Kevin Rudd's ability to be foreign minister based on his personality traits or characteristics, as well as on his style of language. And I always actually thought he is a very good speaker. Now, my question is there anybody in the media who is really supporting Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister, aside from Awe Tulia?
As Foreign Minister, I take it, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, Kevin came to my wedding and he was at my child's christening. I get on very well with him. I'm supporting him. I hope he does well as Foreign Minister.
But he went to Chris Mitchell's wedding too.
true. I think his record as in foreign affairs as Prime Minister was checkered. I read Greg Sheridan this morning, you know, saying that he was a fabulous foreign affairs policymaker as Prime Minister. I don't think I can agree with that. China was vexed. India was ignored. I think Japan was miffed. I think it was a checkered record, and he sailed along on the basis of his Mandarin speaking capacity, but relations with China weren't any better, at least when he left, than when he started. And in fact, in the People's Daily today, the Chinese political class was critical of Rudd's record. So, look, I think he's got a way to go. I think he's got quite a bit to prove. The American alliance is secure. That's one area where he is firm and steadfast. But let's see how he goes.
And you're in charge, yes. But we're finishing reasonably soon, yes?
I remain intensely curious about what Rob Oakeshott's doing in the speakership, and I'd be keen to hear your views. We had 26 minutes of why it was important for him to be able to continue to represent his electorate, and he's turned down a ministry because it's important that he represent his electorate. And while I know that we're looking at reforms to the speakership, he now has stuck his hand up for a highly paid role, which traditionally doesn't allow the member to speak and has no vote. Is this a member who's contemplating he might lose his seat at the next election?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Look,
I think the cynics around might suggest that he's trying to top up his pension by taking on the role, of course. I don't know, and I think I'm like others, particularly in the government, that's finding it hard to come to terms with how this will work. Particularly when the pairing arrangements for independents just don't seem to make any sense, considering they're meant to be based on party political lines. How you assume that an independent is going to vote one way or the other on something, I don't know. So I think they've got a bit to work through on this. I don't think it's assured. In fact, I think they'll be consulting quite heavily with council on the Crown on how this would actually work. I'd find it impossible to see how it would work as Rob Oakeshott Speaker.
Well, thanks to everyone. That's been a great night and a very informative night. No doubt we'll have more discussions like this in the future, but for tonight I'd like to say many thanks for great performances to Simon Benson, and best wishes for his book Betrayal, which has just come out. Thanks also to Margot Saville and to Glenn Milne, who's come up from Canberra for the occasion. Well done, and we'll see you all again soon. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.